Gigi Richard. I don't know if you know Gigi or not, but she's running kind of a similar class, and we're piggybacking on each other. So,
Hi, Peggy.
Nice. Hi, I went to one of her events. Gosh, was it 2 weeks ago? It seems like a long time ago.
Yeah, I gave my students the option to join separately today, Jennifer.
Okay.
We'll wait and see. If nobody shows up here, I'm going to go to my office so I can take my mask off. And all of my students are also required to have their cameras on too.
Okay. Yeah, I see a couple. I see two new ones here, so good.
Yeah, there's Camille. Great.
It's
Awesome.
nice when people turn their cameras on so you don't just see this, printing all over your screen. There's real people there. How big is your class, Jennifer? I see quite a few here.
There's 17
Oh,
that
nice.
I have signed up for the class. Yeah, it's the largest number we've had in a long time. So I'm very pleased.
It's a good thing my dog isn't in here. This doorbell would make him crazy.
Cat's been crying in the background. She thinks she needs treats, so I'm hoping she stays quiet for a while. Welcome, everyone. We're just going to wait a couple of minutes before we get started here. Welcome to the Fort Lewis students.
His hair tie. What is happening here?
Okay, again, welcome. This is Grad 592. We're talking about sustainability and water issues this fall. I watched the tape of Sean Chambers last week on Greeley Water. He had an awful lot of information that he handed out in a short amount of time. I was very pleased to hear your questions also. We're going to shift gears a little bit today, but first of all, a reminder that all the students, both CSU and Fort Lewis, should keep their cameras on. And with the other folks joining us for the public, it's your choice with respect to that. Another reminder, next week we will not be online. This is a special class we're having on CSU campus. It's at the Laurie Student Center. I sent out an email this morning again with the room number for those of my students. It's going to be a really interesting class, so I'm hoping that all of you can make it. With that, let me introduce our guest speaker today. Peggy Montagna is a, I've known Peggy for decades, and she's one of those incredible lawyers, water lawyers that you hear about. She has done litigation. You heard, I can't remember which speaker we had, but they talked about the Forest Service and reserved rights for this Forest Service in the Greeley Water Court. And Peggy was very involved with that. She does water right adjudications, interstate issues. She's been the president appointee for this Interstate Water Commissioner on the, is it Sabine? Sabine?
The Sabine River.
Sabine River between Texas and Louisiana. She was at the Attorney General's office in Colorado before me, and then she moved on to private practice. Peggy was fortunate enough to be appointed to a special task force that was put together by the Department of Natural Resources on water speculation. This is a conversation the legislature and many water geeks have been having for some time. And I asked Peggy here to talk to us a little bit about water speculation and the report. Lucky for you, she doesn't have any PowerPoints. This is going to be a conversation. And so if you have questions, she's going to monitor the chat, but she would ask that you would put your name, you know, this is Dixie, this is my question. And then, and she'll catch it. And if she doesn't, just wave your hand and we'll catch it that way. So she can, I think she can see pretty much all of you. The other thing you need to know about Peggy is she's general counsel to the Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District. And you all had a lot of questions last week to Sean about the CBT project. And there's also a couple other projects going on with Northern Water, the NISP project, which has been in the news, and a Windigap firming project. Peggy has a wealth of information, and so she's just going to roll. Please feel free to ask questions. We want to get a conversation going. And with that, Peggy, over to you.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. Before we started this chat here, I had to, you know, get on early, and I really usually enjoy these things. I told Jennifer that if I wasn't a lawyer, I think I want to be a talk show host. So it's one of those things to think about. You may not want to hear from me by the time this is done, but I do have the chat open. I can read the questions and try to incorporate them into my discussion. When I was thinking about this class, you know, anti-speculation, because that's really what we're talking about. Speculation is the bad thing. And the commission I was on was an anti-speculation committee. Really isn't something you can have pictures of. You know, I have a whole slide deck if you wanted to hear about the East Troublesome Fire and its impact on the CBT project. But what is anti-speculation? And part of the reason that committee was formed, and it was about 20 people, some water users, some lawyers, some engineers, some environmental advocates, people from different parts of the state, was really to talk about what's going on in the world of speculation and how to create laws or otherwise curb speculation, hence the anti-speculation name of the committee. But before you get to that, I think it makes sense to step back and say, okay, what is the role of Colorado water law? What is the role of the law in this speculation issue? And why do we even have that? And so I'm going to start with that and then move into the committee work. So as you know, Colorado was a territory before it was a state, and there was a very developed economy here before Colorado became a state. We had a lot of mining, which we're still dealing with the legacy of 200 years of mining or more. There was agriculture in different parts of the state. The very first water right in the state is from the San Luis Valley, the San Luis People's Ditch. So you had all these people, and then you had a limited resource. There was a lot of land, but there was not a lot of water. So the methodology of dividing and using that water really was around before Colorado became state. So when the Constitution was written, there was respect with and a recognition of the need of water to develop the economy of the state. So one of the things that was in the Constitution is that you have a right to appropriate, so a right to claim usage of the waters of the state of Colorado. Coloradoans have that inherent right by our Constitution. But along with that is the right to appropriate, so you can claim some of that. And then there's kind of a famous quip in some of the old water court cases that says, you have a right to appropriate, but you don't have a right to speculate. Why did that come about? Because this was the age when there were all these resources. There was land to be claimed. There were cities to be founded. There were railroads to be built. And so if you were, you know, a wealthy person, the more resources you could get for yourself, the more you could control that resource. So that, in fact, the U.S. Forest Service case that Jennifer was talking about was one of the primary reasons that the forests were set aside from the general lands of this new country, was in order to provide a steady supply of water to the people below the forest. So this right of use, which is what a water right is in Colorado, you have a right to use it, then you have to return it to the stream after whatever uses are defined, is known as the right to appropriate, but not the right to speculate. Now, the economic underpinnings for that are that as long as that water is available for use, you can use it to build your economy. You can use it for mining. You can use it for, you know, the cattle industry that we have. You can use it for agriculture. We use it as the backbone for the growth of many of our cities and suburban areas. But that has to be protected so that you get what's called maximum utilization. So years ago, there was a crusty old judge up in Greeley who runs the South Platte River water cases. And I was in the attorney general's office. And he used to say, you know, those drops of water that come down from the forest into the South Platte River, we use them 7 times before they leave and go to Nebraska. We wear the water out. And in a way, that's really true. Because when water is used by city, say Fort Collins, then, you know, from the water treatment plant, the water goes out. It's picked up by the next user. Maybe it's used in Windsor. Then it goes down. It's used in Kersey. Then it goes down. It's used in Sterling. And all of the dairies, the agricultural producers, the irrigation in between. And then we deliver water to the state line. And part of the obligations of the state of Colorado are to provide water for the endangered species in central Nebraska. So, you know, we wind up using our water resources for all kinds of consumptive uses. You consume some of it in those uses, and also for non-consumptive uses. And some of the more well-known non-consumptive uses are for things like kayak parks and water parks in cities. I don't know if any of you are big kayakers, but if you go to a number of towns, including Durango, where I am right now, there's a kayak park in the city, and they claim a water right, a recreational in-channel diversion. That water right is defined by the amount of that water they want at the time that it's needed. And then there are some obligations. If they're going to have events, they give notice to other water users because the amount of water that they're going to claim during that time is large. They want big waves for their certain water park features to be able to really function for those uses. So the economic underpinnings for Colorado to protect its water are similar to economic underpinnings that some other states have. So for example, the state of Iowa has limitations on who can own agricultural land in Iowa because they became very concerned that all these outside interests would come into the state and control a big part of their economy without really being invested in the well-being of the state. The state of Washington at one time had laws against taking out of so many logs. It was a timber limitation law. That one did not withstand a legal challenge. It was struck down because it violated the federal commerce clause, allowing interstate commerce between states. So these protective laws around the West, well, and really in the whole country, are not unique. It's just that here, one of our scarce resources is the water availability in our state. So the hoarding of water is not allowed. So we have this historical development, we have mining, we have agriculture, we have some cities. Then you fast forward to today, when we have a very developed economy, we have a lot of people moving to the state of Colorado, and we've become kind of more connected to other states in major ways. And some folks started to be concerned that some parts of our state were kind of investment funds coming in. They know that water is a limited resource here. So You know, just like people can make money off of land, they can make money off of water. So these water started to be traded on the New York Stock Exchange under some kind of private investment groups. And in the valley near Grand Junction, a large water kind of hedge fund came in and purchased a lot of water under one particular ditch. And that raised a lot of red flags. It had been happening in other places. CBT was one place where people were very concerned about that, very cognizant of that. And so the state legislature started thinking about the speculation in water and the anti-speculation doctrine that's in our laws. It has been applied most recently in the last Colorado Supreme Court session. The water court in Greeley denied a water right for a reservoir to a claimant because they couldn't show who was going to use that water. They couldn't show they had a contract for the use of that water. And so the water court dismissed it and said, no, you are a speculator, not an appropriator. That party filed a petition in the Colorado Supreme Court on appeal. After argument, the Colorado Supreme Court agreed with them and said, nope, you're a speculator. You don't get a water right in Colorado. But in any event, so coming back to the hedge fund, this fund bought the water, and around the state, the legislature in particular, was concerned that maybe Colorado water is going to be one of those things like a bushel of corn or a bushel of wheat or 50 head of cattle that people want to start trading and making money on, just like any other commodity. And we don't like that. We're protective of our economy. We're protective of our water supply. Because what speculation is in the eye of the beholder. One person might say you're a speculator and somebody else says, no, I'm not, because you have to look at the intention and some of the actions to try to define that. I said to Jennifer, I don't teach classes very often, but can I say this? Is speculation like pornography? You know it when you see it, but it's hard to describe. So they then appointed this commission to say, okay, commission, you all are experts in this water business. You know, we're legislators. We have to do healthcare, education, transportation, and we're doing water too. You figure out what is the problem with speculation. You understand the anti-speculation doctrine. And if there is some law we can pass or some statute that we can make stronger in order to protect our water supplies, you know, what do you recommend? So this group met, oh, I don't know, 15 or 20 times. We did it on Zoom, just like we're doing today, because we couldn't get together. This was at the height of COVID, to talk about our experiences and our views of what was going on in speculation. And all of us had experiences with it. I, for example, you probably, Jennifer, do too, know of instances where growing cities in Colorado go into a closing room in the afternoon somewhere in an office tower downtown and buy a big part of a ditch. But then they find out that the seller of that bought it in the morning. So they bought the water in the morning, sold it in the afternoon. And so they're just making money on the flip. That, in my view, is water speculation. And it should be guarded against in a big way in Colorado. Is there wholesale speculation under any particular ditch system? I don't think that we found that there was. And then there was a great concern from folks who hold water now. Maybe they inherited a ranch or a farm from their family, or they went out and took out a big loan to buy this ranch and farm. And one of its assets is its water supply. And they've been banking on that. They know that when they go to sell their operation intact with land, water, whatever else comes with it, machinery, farm operations, maybe a good reputation, that that water right will be part of the core of their investment. And so are they speculators? That is a hard question. Maybe this is their 401k. Maybe this is their retirement account. So if we change the law and take that value out from under that water right or that investment, are you really doing the right thing? And there was a huge concern about that from a number of people on the commission. So after looking at a number of concepts, and I understand that you were given a copy of the report, the group decided that they didn't really recommend any change in legislation. There were a lot of ideas like, well, maybe you could set a certain amount of increase that a water right could have over time, tie it to the consumer price index or something. And then if it goes over that, tax it. You know, they keep doing that to marijuana, tax it for this, that, or the other thing. So tax this in order to disincentivize it. So there were ideas about taxing. There were ideas about tying the water to the land. That's one of the things that's often done under a lot of federal projects, is that the water is tied to the land. So you can't buy the water unless you buy the land and they go together. Or it's done under protective bylaws under certain ditch companies. They do it to themselves and say, this water has to stay with this land. And then there are a bunch of modifications on that theme. So there are some that say, okay, if you're going to try to sell your shares in our ditch, you have to make it available to everyone else under the ditch for a year before you can sell it outside of the ditch. And so that those are some of the things, they're called Catlin bylaws, where you can't just move water out of a ditch, but they're protective of the integrity of the system to make sure that the water is not, you know, moved around without giving other water users under the same ditch system an opportunity to buy that water. So I see Dixie has a question. Let's see. Do practices that are being developed to protect against buy and dry, like leasing part of an ag water right to a municipality for a year, tend to line up with anti-speculation efforts? Well, that's interesting. This idea of sharing between ag and municipalities to avoid buy and dry is really what we think of as an alternative transfer method, ATM. And the idea has been around for quite some time. I know Broomfield has an ATM, I think, with a large ranch in Larimer County. I think Aurora has some ATMs with folks down in the Arkansas Valley. And there's really kind of a debate about them. So cities use them 3 out of 10 years, usually under some kind of arrangement. That was the statute, the way it was set up. Is that in a drought, you could use some of that ag water and then go back to that. And people view it as a way to avoid buy and dry. Some of the more cynical agricultural people say it's just slow dry up. It's not as fast as the other kind of dry up. So we'll have to see in 50 years, how did it come out? But it is tied a little bit to that anti-speculation effort. It's also tied to preserving the economy of rural areas. Because if that water goes away, and so the dairy that was using that water isn't operating, the people who work at the dairy get laid off, then they're not going to the hardware store to buy stuff. So it's kind of protective of the agricultural economy in a lot of ways. But these more modern concerns about water speculation are some of what drove the committee. And we didn't come up with any hard recommendations, although I did look today and see, and despite the fact that there were no recommendations from the committee, there are at least 2 bills that are going to be run in the legislature this year to talk about anti-speculation. And I don't know if these are serious efforts to change the law. Sometimes a legislator will run a bill to get the conversation started and to really give some light to a concern they might have, even if they don't expect it to pass. So these could be some of those. I haven't studied them hard, but it'll be interesting to see where those go. So that's why the work under Senate Bill 2048 to evaluate concerns about this, what we called investment water speculation. And we tried to define the old kind of water speculation as traditional water speculation and this new wave of hedge funds and investment funds and those kind of things as investment water speculation rather than traditional water speculation. And then the last thing that I put into the little abstract that I sent in was the legislative process, how the concepts in water law might become, in this speculation arena, might become laws in the future. So water, like many other parts of our state legislature, has what's called an interim water committee. And that committee is appointed by some of the leadership, and they spend quite a bit of time over the summer when the legislature's not in session, hearing from concerned water users. You can sign up and come testify at one of these committees. They sometimes have themes, like they'll have 4 or 5 meetings, and maybe one is all about agriculture. Another one is all about recreation or something. You can come and testify about your concerns. And if you have suggestions about things that you think the legislature should take up, you can come to this interim water committee. Those bills that are committee bills tend to be well vetted. They are scrubbed pretty hard. They have really good language. They fit well within the statute. See those little red books up there? Those are my water volumes. And so, you know, when you draft a bill, you have to make sure the definitions work. The language is consistent, doesn't conflict with some other water statute. And so the ones from the Interim Water Committee tend to come about in that way. There's another whole group of bills that come about because of a specific problem in a specific case. And those really, they can be kind of irritating because I say to myself, really, we're going to change the law around the state because you had one problem in Pueblo and it can be fixed some other way, but you want to change the law for the whole state. But yes, that does happen. And it's not just Pueblo. It can be Grand Junction. It could be Alamosa. Somebody has a problem. They haven't gotten much satisfaction. So they decide they're going to try and change the law for the whole state because that'll solve their problem. So that is another way that we wind up seeing these things. And then there's a whole political side to this. You have a number of lobbying organizations. I myself am a very active member of the Colorado Water Congress. We meet every Monday morning during the legislative session. We take a look at all the bills that could be considered water bills. We debate them. We tear them apart. We make suggestions to the members of the legislature about how they can fix them or what our concerns are. And then we vote on them. And if we vote that, nope, that's a terrible idea, then we go out and lobby against them. And there are a number of other lobby organizations, the Colorado Farm Bureau being one, the Sand and Gravel Group. There's the Colorado Mining Association. There's homeowners or home builders. The home builders group will often like or dislike some kind of legislation. And so, you know, you wind up working through the process during the whole legislative session to see if you can get to a point where bills can be passed. Usually there's a whole group of bills at the beginning of the session, and I like to put them into 3 categories. The, oh, that'll never work, forget that bill. The maybe kind of group, and the, oh, that's a really good idea, and that'll probably go group. But you can be surprised. Rain barrels, for example, were kind of a cause celeb for a number of years. Everybody thought if we could just give everybody rain barrels, that would really solve a lot of our water problems. You probably remember all those rain barrel bills, Jennifer. Yeah. And they came back year after year after year until the rain barrel bill finally passed in one version or another. And, you know, we still have a huge drought on the Colorado River. So it probably was helpful in some regards, but a lot of people were deeply concerned about rain barrels. And that's another example of a bill. It usually happens to come up year after year after year before, you know, something is finally done.
It's fair to say, Peggy, isn't it, that rarely does a bill go through the first time unless it's, you know, there's always these conversations that go on, work that's done. By the way, for those of you listening, the rain barrel bill, the legislature asked CSU, the Water Center, to do a study with respect to that. So they were smart enough to say, we need information. People think they know what's going on, but let's find out what's going on. And After the study, we realized that people could store a couple of rain barrels worth of rain without affecting the overall system. But it's very rare to see, you know, short of COVID, to see something going through straight through.
It's extraordinarily rare, unless there's really some emergency, and it's usually a pretty simple bill if it actually goes through. So the one that comes to mind that, you know, took up a lot of airspace last year was the Waters of the United States definition. The Trump administration, through rulemaking, had reduced the scope of waters that could be considered for federal permitting under the Clean Water Act. The state became very concerned that a lot of the waters of the state of Colorado would not be protected under the reduced scope of the federal bill. So they put together a state bill so that there could be a whole permitting system under state law. But, you know, it was clunky, it was difficult, it was hard to put your arms around. And after a lot of work, it ultimately did not pass, even though there were some very hard charging people who were behind trying to create a state permit program. But, you know, there were a lot of also financial issues. Every bill comes with what's known as a fiscal note. And the note explains, okay, if you pass this bill, what's the financial impact on the state of Colorado? Are you going to have to hire two more full-time employees, FTE? Are you going to have money available for enforcement? Are you going to have to have, you're going to have to hire scientific types to be able to figure out how to decide if something is a wetland or not a wetland? The impact on endangered species. So many times a bill will fail or, you know, not get a lot of support because it has a huge fiscal note. And that was true with the state permitting program. It was an enormous fiscal note. Plus, there was this back and forth at the federal level. Okay, if the next presidential administration decides to go back to the old rule, then what do you do with this whole permit program that you've started? Do you shut it all down? What do you do? So yeah, it is very rare that a water bill winds up being adopted in the first year that it's proposed because they can be extraordinarily complex. They affect a large parts of our economy. And then the geographic differences around our state. I mean, one of the things to also think about in this anti-speculation arena is that, you know, Colorado is the mother of 11 rivers. We owe water to every state that's downstream of us. All, we're the headwater state. We send water to Nebraska. We send water to Kansas. We send water to New Mexico that then goes to Texas, that then goes to Mexico. We send water, you know, in the Colorado River to all the downstream states. You probably read if you've watched about the upper basin and the lower basin on the Colorado River and all the states that are affected. But within our own state, we have such a diversity of geography that it's difficult to envision the state laws that impact everyone the same. So the Yampa River, for example, doesn't have a dam on it. It's a free-flowing river, huge economy, Steamboat Springs, and that recreation economy and the headwaters. Then you go down, you have Dinosaur National Park and all the in-between stuff. But then you have the South Platte River, which has Denver and the whole metropolitan area, and then goes on through Weld County and all the other counties down to Nebraska.
So Penny, let me ask you, you mentioned about water and politics. Talk a little bit about that, because it's, as I see it, it's not the traditional red and blue. It's a different kind of politics.
Yeah, so I guess I would divide that up, Jennifer, into kind of intrastate politics, the agricultural community versus the urban community. The more I work in law and in water, you realize there's a huge urban-rural divide in our state. And the politics of that are really important, because we need to bridge that gap between the people in the urban areas, the suburban areas surrounding kind of Fort Collins to Colorado Springs, and then the true agricultural communities. So the politics at the State House around the vote on a bill, water bill, land bill, some other kind of bill, really do matter. Politics matter. Then there's the federal politics, where it's not so much red and blue either. It really is around the environmental, the big five environmental organizations have a huge impact on what goes on at the federal level in terms of water politics. But the big states with a lot of voting power, like California, who's at the bottom of the Colorado River, Texas, who's at the bottom of the Rio Grande, they have a lot more people in Congress than we do. And thank goodness Colorado's going to get another congressperson this year, certainly soon enough to catch us up with some of the big states. But politics play a big role in water policy.
Okay. I would add to that also in state, the East Slope versus West Slope conversation.
Yes, all the Trans Mountain diversions.
And then Jan had a question in the chat, Peggy.
Okay. Can you describe the law process of an agricultural farm intended to save water sell to cities for extra profit? It sounds like speculation, but water efficiency on a farm is needed. This is a really timely concept. So what I think of, and Jennifer, I value your input here. You know, typically agricultural farms are watered historically by flood irrigation. So you had flood irrigation. There was an old formula called the Blaney-Criddle formula when you went to water court that pretty much said that half of the water that's applied on furrow irrigation returned to the stream and half was used by the crop. So it was kind of a 50-50 deal. That varied based on the kind of crop. Alfalfa is a high water use crop. Small grains are low water use crop. But then as, you know, water became more important, then agriculture went to a lot of sprinkler irrigation. That increased the efficiency. It allowed farmers to irrigate more lands under some circumstances. In some places, you couldn't do that. So that saved water was not really available to be used in a different way if you didn't have more acres. So there wasn't really an incentive to do a lot of that. So what Jan's question really goes to is if you can make yourself more efficient, your crop is still using, if you don't change your crop is still consuming that 50%. So when you go to change your water right, you don't have a right to all the water that gets spread across your field. That return flow belongs to the stream, because if you apply it in Weld County, it's going to flow down the South Platte and it belongs to that irrigator in the lower South Platte. And they're very protective of their return flow. So increasing efficiency doesn't always make water available to a city. You really have to give up some of your consumptive use. Either have to go to a lesser demanding crop, or you have to dry up some of your acres to make that water available. And then the other idea of the ATMs, where you would fallow all or part of your farm in order to make that water available to a city under an alternative transfer method, an ATM, in a drought year, is kind of a way of recognizing that. But it's a tough concept. People think, well, if I have a water right, why can't I use it all? And if I make myself more efficient, why can't I sell half of that to a city? That just doesn't really work under the Colorado system because of the maximum utilization and the historic consumptive use. And I can talk more about that if you really want to geek out, but that gets pretty boring for a lot of people.
Peggy, there's another question from Brennan.
I'm reading it now. Going off the topic of water politics, the urban-rural divide, would you say this divide is growing? Do you think building consensus between two groups is still possible? Was during the post-war era? You know, I think it is growing, and this is a personal opinion. This is not a, didn't take any kind of poll, but I think there's a lot of, how do I say this politely? We have a lot of people moving into our state, and they're moving between Fort Collins and Colorado Springs. You know, I'll say to them, you know, what about Southern Colorado? And they think Southern Colorado is Pueblo. They've never been past there. They haven't been to the San Luis Valley. They want to go to the West Slope. They think that's Telluride. You know, they don't go to Nucla. They don't go to Montrose or Delta. So I think there is a lot of an urban-rural divide. And I think that organizations like Water Education Colorado, WECO, the new center at Fort Lewis, to talk about water politics and try to bridge that gap, I think that's really important. And I think it's also just incumbent on people to realize that the way you use water in your little community is really innately tied to this web we have of water around the state. If we as a state become all urban and we dry up all of the agricultural part of our state, you lose a lot of culture, you lose a lot of history, and you lose a lot of kind of what makes Colorado a great place to live. So, you know, I don't know enough about the post-war era. That's part of Brennan's question. But I do think that we're kind of at a precipice where we who like are taking this class, or we who go to places where water really is talked about, the water politics of the state, have an obligation to try to bridge that urban-rural divide, because I do see it. And I'll suggest to people, you know, next time you decide to go on a driving trip, you know, go past Pueblo, go on down to Alamosa and kind of see what they're doing with water down there. You know, go look at the cranes. The Bonavista Vista Crane Festival is awesome. You'll enjoy it. And if you're going to go to the West Slope, you know, maybe take a more holistic view of what the West Slope is like. Because Jennifer's right, the West Slope and the East Slope, with all of the water diversions that go, they take West Slope water to the East Slope and really drive the economy of the East Slope, something a lot of people don't know about. And hopefully more of them will be interested.
So I wanted to know, Professor Richard, if you want to hop in here on this particular issue, because I know you set up this water center and you might have some thoughts about this. She's got to come closer to the...
Yeah.
The button to unmute is over there. So, I think it's a really good question, thinking about bridging that urban-rural divide, and having spent time in the Grand Valley and then now in Southwest Colorado. I think Peggy, you really nailed it with that a lot of the residents of our urban areas really don't have a sense of what's happening in our rural areas and how our water is put to, how our water plays such a foundational role in the economy and the activities and the livelihood and the soul of so much of these rural areas. I'm really excited about the ways that both the Water Center at CMU and the Water Center at Fort Lewis, I think, are serving to help educate our college students, and then also do a lot more community outreach, and where we are trying to engage and bring folks together from our rural areas and connect them and connect the people who are in our more urban and suburban areas with what's happening with their water. So I think that is really important. And you know, the roundtables, and there's so many things that happen in the state where we, in the water world, those communities do connect. But I think you made a really good point that it's the average person that really doesn't have any idea that their Front Range water is coming from the West Slope. And WECO's, you know, they're doing a lot of work in that way as well.
Great.
Yeah. I was also going to make a comment about Brian's comment here, and then I see we have another one. You know, the economic view, economists will argue, well, if you just make water more expensive, then people won't waste it, and that'll be more effectively used. But in my view, that's just one lens that we need to look at water from. Yes, there's an economic issue. There's also the economies of our entire state. There's also, do you really want all of your food to be imported from another country? The value of the food and fiber that is part of our agricultural economy. I do think that technology, which is also mentioned here, is an important thing. I told Jennifer, I have a list of things. If we run out of talking about anti-speculation, there's so much more going on. And technology and advances in technology is very much on the list. Everybody in the water world has a pet peeve, and I'll tell you what mine is that people think if they're using non-treated water, that it's okay to have huge green space, huge golf courses, huge everything, because that's not drinking water. Well, hello, that's still water. And that is water that can become drinking water through water treatment. So yes, it counts in the water equation. Just because your favorite golf course uses non-potable water, you are not off the hook. That water can be a water supply for a lot of other things. And that's my pet peeve. But I think that smarter use of agricultural water, if you can afford it, it's the cost of technology that a lot of times keeps agriculture using low-tech methods. It's not that they don't know they're out there. It's that they're expensive. That smarter use of ag water can be helpful. Also, a lot of crops. There's a lot of study going on, particularly at CSU, but other places, of growing the same crop with half the amount of water. You can get 80% of the yield with 50% of the water. That's a good delta. And they're looking at some things like that. Now, my son would say, oh, wait a minute, are you talking about Frankenfood? I don't want my GMO stuff. So there's that issue to deal with. And then a lot of, you know, moving away from the big green lawns everywhere, you know, more of the garden in the box kind of things that a lot of water providers are starting to allow in their communities, and getting rid of these HOA rules that say you have to have so much grass in your front yard. Those were outlawed a few years ago. So if your HOA still has them, they're against the law, ignore them. This is what I say. But, you know, I think technology has a big role to play. Now I see we have another message. Oh, the North Fork Valley, where you don't want to talk about Denver water. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, that's tough. The idea that these are shady backroom deals, I think that's going away. I mean, if you look at some of the old pictures, Jennifer, that you probably have in the CSU Water Archive, it's a bunch of old guys in suits standing around the table. They might even be smoking cigars. And that's kind of, I think, the history of water in Colorado. But, you know, the doors are wide open now. People want to get to that. It's available.
And Denver has evolved. I mean, Denver was considered the iron fist in anything going on with developing water. And they evolved to be more open and transparent about what they're doing. We still consider them an iron fist. We just think they have a velvet glove on them.
The 500-pound gorilla. Nobody's asked me a question, your Northern Water question. I thought that might come up.
Well, I was curious from your perspective of Northern Water. Mm-hmm. And Denver, both Northern and Denver are working to expand some of their use of the Colorado River water with Windigat firming in the Denver project, whose name just escaped me.
Moffitt
firming. So, you know, talk about firming. What's a firming project?
So I can talk very, very in particular about Windigat firming, because I worked on the permits for that and the water court case for that. So what happened was that water right is a junior water right. It's not in priority all the time. It's pretty much a spring flow water right. It diverts in, you know, as the river comes up in the springtime, the snow melts, and then it goes out. It's out of priority by July. In a good year, maybe August 1st. So you can't really have a municipal water supply that's only available 3 months out of the year. So you have to store that water. So when the project was first built, some of you have probably been over to the small reservoir near Granby on the Upper Colorado River. That has a pipeline that leads over into Grand Lake. And so the idea was they would pick the water up when it was available. They got 45 days of pumping. It's 600 CFS, which is a lot of water. Big pipes, you can walk through them. and then store that water in Granby Reservoir. And then from there, it would be delivered on. Well, that was the idea, but turned out it didn't work so well because they can only use storage space in Granby when the CBT project is not using it. So what would happen is that the Windy Gap project would get available water. Maybe they could pump 40,000 acre feet, but Granby Reservoir was already full. And so they would wind up dumping the Windy Gap water. And so the idea of using excess storage in CBT just didn't work. And they realized that over a number of years. Well, there had always been the idea of building another reservoir on the west slope near Granby. But it turned out they couldn't permit that reservoir because of environmental concerns. There were a lot of wetlands, fens. Have you ever dealt with fens, which are kind of special wetlands? I'm not a biology person, but you don't touch those. So then the idea was, well, then instead of storing it over there, why don't we just bring it through the tunnel early and store it on the Front Range? So a firmed project is one that had less reliability under its original kind of construct with, you know, the reservoirs and the way it is. Now with Chimney Hollow Reservoir, it'll be available more often during drought times. So the water now is more reliable. So you could call it the Windy Gap Reliability Project, but it's called the Windy Gap Firming Project. It makes that water more reliable for those cities and towns that depend on it during drier times. By bringing the water over early, storing it there north of Fort Collins, I worked on that project with Larimer County. Larimer County wanted to do a land conservation project. We wanted to build a reservoir. So an agreement was struck between Larimer County and Northern Water. They get the uplands for open space, recreation, biking, day use, picnicking things. We get the bottom of the area for water storage with an agreement to protect water quality. So it'll be non-motorized only. And all the land treatment they do up there has to protect against erosion. They can't use certain pesticides and that kind of thing to control weeds because that's a drinking water supply. So I think, you know, that's kind of a win-win in a lot of ways. And it's finally permitted and under construction.
I think that it just shows how complex these projects are. Martha has a really interesting question in the chat.
Why wouldn't construction of reservoirs in anticipation of growth not be considered speculative? Oh, so this is another water geek thing. So the speculation doctrine in Colorado, or the anti-speculation doctrine, allows for municipal water suppliers, the Denver Waters, the Northern Waters, the City of Aurora, Pueblo, City of Durango, where I'm close to right now, to be able to look out 50 years. You can look out 50 years and say, what is my need going to be 50 years from now? And then you can develop your water supply to that 50-year time horizon. Because of the recognition of how complex it is to envision a project that's going to, first you have to have a plan. Then you have to figure out, you know, all the engineering. You have to acquire the land. You have to study the water yield and make sure it's going to work. Then you have to permit the project, which can take more than a decade. And then you have to finance a project like that. So you have to go to the market, issue bonds, figure out, you know, how you're going to pay for the bonds, tax the people who are going to get the water supply. So because you have to build that supply to be able to make sure those suburban areas are going to have firm water supply for schools, for hospitals, for housing, for municipal buildings. That's why building in advance is not speculative. It's a set aside, if you will, from the anti-speculation doctrine. There's
Colorado Supreme Court called that the Great and Growing Cities Doctrine.
Right. When Denver wanted to appropriate water from now what's Dillon Reservoir and build a tunnel under the Continental Divide to deliver it, it was named the Vidler Tunnel. The court said, oh no, that's speculative. And then Denver went out and did it. So it wasn't so speculative after all. But anyway, that's a direct answer to that one, is that it's not speculation. If
It's a great question.
Yeah.
And if you have a couple more minutes, there was controversy about how the cities determined how much water they needed, like whether or not, you know, how their population projections, were they solid? Were they, could they stand scrutiny? And there was a case down in your part of the state there, Peggy, where the court said, you know, this doesn't quite sound right. You guys need to go back and do some homework. So the cities have to make sure they have a solid basis in what they think is going to happen in the next 50 years. We're coming up on the end here. Are there any other questions or comments for Peggy at this point? Go ahead, Professor Richard.
Peggy, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what's happened in the Grand Valley that pushed this whole effort to explore anti-speculation. Because I think, you know, WAM has purchased farms which have shares of Grand Valley Water Users Association water tied to them. And so how can that, can you talk about how that can be speculation? Like, what could they possibly do with that water since the water is actually tied to the land there?
It's interesting that you asked that question, because one of the members of the study group was exactly from that ditch. And the concern was that somehow they could control the company, that if you bought enough of land and water together under a certain company, that you could wind up kind of controlling that. And while it's good now that if they get too big, obviously every share comes with a vote, that they could change the rules. Also, because they're so close to the state line, if you know, we're in a mega drought on the Colorado River, and if water needs to be delivered downstream to other states, what better place than to take out crops that are close to the state line? So again, it's some of this geography that we have to deal with in Colorado. A lot of times water laws or water concerns are looked at from an interstate compact perspective. And if the change in the law will undermine our ability to comply with a state compact, interstate compact, then often, you know, we change it and try to fix that problem. But the concern was that, okay, here's the simple scenario. Colorado all of a sudden has to deliver more water down the Colorado River. They decide to dry up a part of the Grand Valley. We tax the people of the state of Colorado to pay the owners of that water who are sitting in their office in New York to not use their water. Is that really for the good of the state of Colorado? So, you know, that's some of the talk that goes on. But that's really what drove some of that. You know, another thing that I just want to mention, because we are running out of time, it's almost 5 o'clock and nobody wants to stay late. Dinner's probably getting ready right now, is that in the last 6 months, I've worked a lot on the mega fires, the Cameron Peak fire, and then the East Troublesome fire that came. And if you all saw it on the news, burned incredible parts of the national forest. And that forest is what provides water supply. You've probably seen the Poudre River run black if you've been down by the river. We are working furiously to mulch the forest, to look at reseeding, to look at what they call beaver dam analogs, where you go in and you replicate what beavers would do if they were in the forest, to retard that, to be able to discharge silt out into some open areas instead of just letting all the ash run down the river. So I think that was an unanticipated local event. I mean, we see fires around the West, and I really think we're going to see more of them. You know, they really impact the water supply for our state in the headwaters. And it's expensive to do this remediation work. Northern to date has $35 million worth of projects, including helicopter mulching going on. We're probably looking at another $40 million worth of remediation. And Jennifer, as you know, being one of the directors of Northern Water, all that money is not fully compensated by the grants that we get from the federal government. Some comes out of the revenues. And so there's things we can't do because this is priority work. So, you know, that's probably my last comment on. Doesn't really go with speculation, but it's important stuff.
Well, Peggy, and we do have Esther Vincent coming to talk to us.
Oh, good.
In a few weeks. So, but the aspect I think is important that, as you recall, one of my favorite quizzes is, what's the largest reservoir in Colorado? And the answer is snowpack. So I can't go by one class without saying that once or twice. So that's great. Peggy, thank you so much. This was very informative. Let's give Peggy a hand.
Thank you all. You put up with an hour of water talk. A lot of people wouldn't do that.
So thank you so much. For the general public, we'll see you in 2 weeks. For the class, for Grad 592 CSU, we'll see you next week in person. Have a good evening.
Thank you.